Welcome to our 12th lesson in the book of Daniel, and I've called it Marduk's Feet, Disunity in Unity. I want to take a very brief look at the previous four levels, or four sections, of this statue and the vision of Nebuchadnezzar, in which he is requiring that anyone who is going to give him an interpretation must do so by telling him his dream. And we went over that in great detail in our previous lessons, that only Daniel, through the power of God, could do this, because it was God who gave Nebuchadnezzar the vision of future of world kingdoms. Now, we say the world kingdoms, but we actually mean the lost empires. And God chose these four to show us the progression from the ancient world to the modern world, to our own day, what it was built on, and its fallibilities. The head is made of gold, which never tarnishes, and of course Nebuchadnezzar was saved. So his legacy of salvation will never tarnish. But his legacy here on earth, which is taken over by others after his death, will certainly tarnish. Obviously, it was defeated. But it was basically the pinnacle of Mesopotamian culture. And one of its focuses was God-given laws over man. The king was the intercessor between the God who gave the laws and the king who implemented those laws and interpreted those laws and was sort of the court of last appeal. Then we go to the Medo-Persian Empire, which is the chest of silver. Remember, it tarnishes very quickly and is black. It rubs off. Well, Cyrus, though he was anointed of God, and we don't want to be confused, none of these people operated without the consent of God. Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 7. The governments and kings are appointed of God. That doesn't mean that they are spreading the gospel, or they have an understanding of the truth of God, or if they are even aware of this, lost people are not. All of us are doing the will of God. We're not automatons. We're not fixed. But we each respond according to our nature. There's a cat will always be a cat. A sinner will always act as a sinner, though in varying degrees of differences within that. But they still all come from the same source, the asabeia, the ungodliness. That Paul gives us great insight into this in Romans 1, verses 18 through 32. But Persia is the first Japheth. The Babylon Empire was the last Shemitic. The Persian is the first Japhetic Empire. And Cyrus allowed the Jews to go back and rebuild the temple. Then came the Grecian Empire, the Hellenistic Empire, the bronze, the loins of, and thighs. Now, when it tarnishes, it has a green patina. It doesn't rot the metal. The metal still stands, but it dulls the shine. It changes the sheen, so it no longer appears as bronze. It appears as this green, alluring patina that attracts people, and that's what Hellenism did. It developed the philosophy and seeded this into surrounding kingdoms and future kingdoms, that man is the measure of all truth. Man has become God. And rationalism marks the fleshly passions, and it's evidenced by the increasing violence even today. But God used Hellenism, as he used Persia, to prepare the world to receive Christ at his first coming. Then we have the Roman Empire, the legs of iron that stomp into pieces all that it comes in contact with. But rust rots all the way through. See, the tarnishing of silver will eventually eat away the silver as you rub it off and expose the clean surface to the oxygen. It'll undergo that chemical reaction, but once the black is there, the reaction stops. Same way with bronze, it does not go all the way through. But once iron starts to rust, it goes all the way through. And it will actually deteriorate the iron into this red powder. See, Rome was divided throughout its history. It had obscure origins, as we discussed in our lesson. And it absorbed admired qualities from other cultures to such an extent that they didn't even know their own origins. They had to make them up out of myth, out of whole cloth, so to speak. But they advanced Hellenism from man is the measure of all to man is God. With the rise of the empire, the first emperor, Augustus, or Octavian, which was his given name, Augustus just means first, because he was the principus, he was the first citizen. On his death, the Senate voted him into godhood. And from that origin grew emperor worship. As long as you paid obeisance to the emperor, you could believe in your approved religion. Now, if Rome thought your religion was subversive, they would not approve it, and of course, you could be killed for that. But it didn't matter what your faith was, as long as it was in the approved category, as long as you acknowledge the deity of the emperor. That was the overarching pattern that is going to be copied by this future kingdom, as we're going to see. But the government itself of Rome crumbled due to relativism. Due to this, it had no inner stability. Its morality was not fixed. And it kept changing until it had no strength at all. And Rome literally was not defeated per se. It just faded away. The Western Empire. But it became the foundation of Western culture in its revival in the Renaissance. Now we have come to today's lesson, the feat of iron and clay, disunity in union. This kingdom is future to us, though in the making since the end of Rome. Actually, it's been in the making since creation. It is built on previous kingdoms, but adds a unique non-metallic modern dimension that has not been seen in the previous sections. See, history can't define this empire because it is still future to us. Yet, prior empires can give us clues about the nature of this empire. And people, down through church history, that have tried to focus on identifying this empire, especially since the Reformation, have just come up with bizarre fantasies by and large. It's the Pope, it's in Rome, it is this, it is Islam, it is that. And it just leads people astray. And we're going to talk briefly about why that happens. But this division, this division. This vision defines what each empire adds to Satan's final empire. This is our focus, normative hermeneutical interpretation. That is what we care about. We care about letting the Bible define the Bible, just as we let math defines math. If you say letting the Bible define the Bible is circular reasoning, all man's reasoning is circular reasoning in that respect. We let science define science, just as we let math define math. Now, we're going to start with the law of identity, which means that we're going to start with, what did Daniel actually say? So we go to Daniel 2, verse 41 through 43, and we will read them together here. And as you saw, the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness or strength of iron shall be in it. And just as you saw the iron mixed with the soft or fragile clay, and as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. Brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with the soft clay, so they shall or will mix with one another in the ESV it says in marriage. But in this unity, trying to integrate into this one new entity is pretty much what the Hebrew is trying to get across. It's a difficult word because it's only used this one time, and it's not really a Hebrew word, it's an Aramaic word. And it talks about man and seed and stuff. So the sense that we're trying to get out of this, that the translators are trying to form, is that they come together into a oneness. And just like Adam said in Genesis chapter 2, when God presented him with woman that came from him, he said, the two shall be one. Well, that is the sense that they're trying to convey here by using the word marriage. The two shall become one, except they won't become one. That is the attempt, but that is also the failure. But they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. So to arrive at a coherent interpretation, we must begin with the clear teaching of Scripture, exegesis. We get our meaning out of the Scripture. We do not read our meaning into the Scripture. That's adding our opinion. And it always causes error. And when Daniel said, as you saw the toes and the feet, Nebuchadnezzar never forgot his dream, as some incorrectly assume. He knew his dream. That was never the problem. He never said, I don't know my dream, tell me my dream. This was his test. How can I believe your interpretation? The meaning of this vision is so important, you have to prove that you have the correct interpretation. And the only proof that you can offer is that you tell me the dream. And that's what we covered in our lesson on that, and that is why the wise men of Babylon and all the other wisdom that Babylon had accrued from other nearby cultures failed, because Satan could not know what was in his head. Satan is not omniscient. He does not read minds. And if Nebuchadnezzar kept his mouth shut and didn't tell anybody, guess who didn't know what the dream was? Satan. Thus, he couldn't tell anybody. He couldn't pass it on. Thus, they said, the Chaldean wise men said, what you ask is impossible of man. It belongs to the gods. Well, no, it didn't. It belonged to God, because God gave it to him. And the only way Daniel learned of it is God gave it to Daniel. Now, Daniel is authenticating his interpretation, and he is just reminding Nebuchadnezzar that he is only talking or reiterating what Nebuchadnezzar only knew, already knew. You saw the feet. You saw the iron. You saw the clay. Here is what they mean. He is authenticating and reminding Nebuchadnezzar that he is authenticating his interpretation. And thus, Daniel clearly stated before, and he's going to state it again, that this is not him, that this comes from God, that he is merely God's conduit for the king. Both kings, the father, who is king over all, and Nebuchadnezzar, who's the little k, the tiny king, over his little patch of ground on earth. But the emphasis here focuses on a divided kingdom. It's not only the 2 feet, it's the 10 toes. Everything is divided. The 10 toes come together into the 2 feet, but even they are divided. 5 on each foot. It references, I believe, back to Rome, since it connects to the legs and it shows qualities from the legs, which are iron, and there's iron in the feet. And thus, remember in our last lesson when we covered this, we said that Rome was divided into a Western or Latin and Eastern or Greek empires. But since they originated from the Western Empire, from Rome, we believe that is the source. Yes, the Byzantine Empire lasted 1,000 years longer, but it contributed nothing. It is the Western Empire that contributed everything. The Byzantine Empire kind of Hellenized it and held on to it, but didn't do anything with it. They didn't expand. They did try to come back and revive the Western Empire for a time, but failed. And then even they, too, went away. But they were actually defeated in combat. Rome just kind of faded. And this kingdom begins with 2 inherently different concepts pretending to merge into one. Satan is the strong one, but man is fragile. Man leaves his body of clay at death. And we're going to see here in a moment why I say the clay represents man. See, the spirit and the physical cannot mix. Biology. I know. People go back to Genesis chapter 6. Sons of God. Daughters of men. And angels are marrying women. And giants came. And but you just got to stop. You just got to think biology. Because if angels could do this. Demons. We're saying demons could do this, then what is the point of possessing anyone? It makes no sense. If you're able to make your own children and they can help sway over everyone, then why not just continue that? What is the point of demon possession then? And we see nothing of this occurring, and because man can only reproduce with people. dogs can only reproduce with dogs, cats with cats, monkeys with monkeys, so on and so forth. Each kind reproduces after its own kind within its own kind. Angels are spiritual. There's no way to mate. They try and to copy what God did. Now God is God. God is creator. But God only made man once from nothing, from the earth. Woman came from man. God miraculously cloned her, gave her a soul in a different personality from man. That is a creative act that only God can do. God was able to take Mary's eggs and cause them to grow, but still, it comes from man. He was able to mutate it into a male body because God, and put Christ's nature within that body, because that body was made for Christ to indwell. Demons have been trying to do this. That's why we see demon possession in the Gospels and nowhere else in the Old Testament. They didn't get that idea until they saw God do it. And since they could not have, they did not possess the creative powers to do what God did, even though some so-called Bible scholars claim they did have that. They didn't. We don't see any evidence of it anywhere in Scripture. We see this attempt to force the spirit into the physical. It's always disastrous. Now, it's not going to remain disastrous, but their first attempts were terrible. We had the demonic of Gensadia. And we saw that chains couldn't bind him, and he's frothing, and he's screaming, and he's terrible. And he was filled by a legion of spirits. That's a lot, just so you know. And when Christ cast them out, the demons went into the swine and drove them insane, and they ran off the cliff into the sea. They don't mix willingly. And then the man was in his right mind. And when he wanted to come with Christ, Christ says, no, you stay here in your land and you spread the gospel. You spread the good news. And he did. But this begins to tell us that there is a significant difference between what God can do and what Satan, his demons, and all angels cannot do. Now, God's angels don't attempt this. The demons do. Now, we have to remember that the angels and the demons are fallen angels. And whenever we read Satan, we should be thinking Satan and demons. He is their head. He is their representative. But he controls them with an iron hand so that they are identified directly with him and through him. Now, all angels are created as ministering spirits. Hebrews 1, 13 and 14. That's their mission, to do whatever God tells them to do. And they're here to serve man in salvation. And in that sense, they have a certain nature of God, since he is also spirit. And we read that in John 4, 23 and 24. Remember the woman at the well. And they're discussing how to worship God, and Christ tells her, if you're going to worship God, you worship him in spirit and in truth, for God is spirit. And those who worship him must worship him in spirit. And the angels are spirits. Man is not spirit. Man is different. Man is body and spirit. Angels are just spirit. But their nature is such that it is not made directly in the image of God. Now, it's about all that we can say, because the Bible doesn't tell us much more than that. But we do know that man was made directly in the image of God. So Lucifer was created for certain purposes, because he's a ministering spirit. But he sinned when he rebelled against God's purposes for his creation. In other words, he got confused and he wanted to be as God. Now, go through and read Isaiah 14, 12 through 14, and Ezekiel 28, 13 through 18. And it discusses this in great detail, but condensed down. You're going to have to meditate it and unpack it and explore this, not only in Scripture, but also how it plays out in life around us. But you have to remember, the angels are not gods. This Satan is not God. He is not omniscient. He does not have the qualities of God. He is not omnipresent. He is not omnipotent. These are all the qualities of God. And this is evident by the fact that they do not understand salvation. Their nature is limited when compared to man. In 1 Peter 1, chapter 1:10. And drop down to the end of verse 12. Let's read all of verse 12. And it was revealed to them. That means the prophets who were writing the Old Testament didn't understand everything that they were writing. They'd go back and read the writings and try to understand the fullness, the meaning of the writing. Who were they referring to? Well, we all do that today. In fact, that is where the problem comes in to trying to identify this particular empire with what you see around you when it hasn't even come into creation yet, as far as we know. It will be revealed in its time. But it was revealed to them that they were not serving themselves, but those in the future, which from Peter's time and our time is us. And things that have been announced. Things into which the angels long to look. Angels do not understand salvation. This shows that their nature is limited compared to man. Angels that rebelled against their authorized position and proper abode, and those being spirit beings, and the dwelt people, became out of control by the experience. It was negative for both the demons and the people. And every time we see the demons in the Gospels and Acts, the person is negatively impacted. And the demons aren't doing much better. In fact, that many of them had to be chained. They were so changed by their experience. And they were chained in Tartar. Might say the abyss. And it would be released during the Great Tribulation. for a purpose. But Scripture shows the result of angels mixing with people, seeking to emulate God's work of preparing a body for Christ. And the results, as I said, were disastrous. Angels are not exempt from judgment for sin. Remember, sin is rebellion, and it has only one mantra. There can be only one. But man is another kind. Whereas Satan is the iron, resolute, unchanging, doesn't die, man is the clay. Now we know this because the Bible tells us directly. In Genesis 2:7, man is the clay. He's made directly from the earth. And when man dies and decomposes, it goes back to being the earth. And yet, man, being the only other sentient creation of God, is very different from angels. The psalmist talks about this in Psalms 8:4 through 8, and the writer of Hebrews picks up on this in chapter 2, verses 5 through 9. That we start out in this life lower than angels, but in the next life, those who are saved, we will judge angels. And Paul writes about this. And we were made in God's image, Genesis 1, 26 through 27. Thus, that is where we get our sense of morality, our sense of right and wrong, and the ability to examine and tell the difference, which is discernment, which is what we are required to do today. Hebrews 5, 11 through 14. See, and sin, when it separated man from God and it transformed our godly nature into ungodliness, yet we still possess elements of that nature of God that makes us very different from angels. Our perceptions are different. Our comprehensions, our understandings are different. Now, to give you a sense of the difference here, angels administered the law. That's what they know. You do bad, you get punished. You do bad, you get punished. You do bad, you get punished. And pretty much that's kind of how sinners think too. That's why all lost religions are works-based. We do good, maybe we get good. Maybe if our good outweighs the bad, we'd be okay. That's how angels think. Because man lost that capacity, not completely, but significantly. But the angels never had that capacity. They only knew, you do A, you get B. P implies Q. But the new covenant gospel of Christ, which comes only through people, see, only people spread the gospel. The angels don't understand it. Now, Scripture refers to man as clay several times, giving us a direct metaphor of the clay in Nebuchadnezzar's vision. And we're going to look at a couple of passages just to show you how far back this goes. Isaiah 29, 15 and 16. Ah, you who hide deep from the Lord your counsel, whose deeds are in the dark, and who say, who sees us? Who knows us? You turn things upside down. Shall the potter be regarded as the clay? The thing that the thing made should say of its maker, he did not make me, or the thing formed say of him who formed it, he has no understanding? Now here he's talking directly of sinners, and we see how their nature has been shattered, but not completely. They still possess some qualities in the image of God. Let's go to Isaiah 64. And this predates the famous passage in Jeremiah. But now, O Lord, you are our Father. We are the clay, and you are the potter. We are all the work of your hand. We go to Jeremiah 18, which is the passage most people would be familiar with. It runs throughout most of that particular passage. The word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, "Arise, get unto the potter's house, and there I will let you hear my words." Then the word of the Lord, in verse 5, came to me, "O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter has done?" declares the Lord. And Paul picks up the same imagery in Romans chapter 9, verses 20 through 24. And he talks about it again in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 5. "For what we proclaim is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, with ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. God who said, 'Let the light shine out of darkness,' has shown our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that surpassing power of God belongs to God and not to us." See, that is why the gospel only comes through people. Angels can't understand it. They cannot grasp. Why did God indwell a man? He who was God become very lower. And then die. Allow his body, his holy person, to be beaten. They don't understand that. They were ready to tear everything apart. So we see that man is the clay. Now in Adam, who had been given dominion over all the earth, in Genesis 1, 26 through 30 and 2, 19 through 20, sinned, he unwittingly became a slave to Satan. Thus his dominion passed to Satan. And Satan, also a slave to his own nature, slave to sin. And when he caused man to sin, he ensured his own judgment through man. See, he was being so clever. He was going to cause man to sin so that man would never be above him, and he would then be ruler over man. But the moment that he caused Adam to sin, because Adam sinned willingly, but woman was deceived. And thus woman, in her sin, was going to become the vehicle of his destruction. And so what we see here is that Satan did not understand the differences between him and people. He looked down on them. He did not comprehend. He did not know what he did not know. And if he just was well enough alone, but he couldn't because he had already sinned. Therefore, he was driven by sin to do sin and to propagate sin and to bring all under the dominion of sin. Thus, he released these forces he could not control. But he's been trying to control ever since. Satan literally failed when he succeeded in Adam. See, Satan learning how to bring man under his dominion. That's what these kingdoms show. His attempts, okay, can't work that way. Let me try it this way. Let me try it. But overall unity, he's been doing this, just changing his methodology. all in the form of an idol. Why? Because he's spirit. He cannot be seen by us. How do you reach out to those who cannot see you? You must do it through something they can see, that they can comprehend. Thus, the idol is the focuser. See, Christ was the focuser. Christ was the intercessor between man and God. He became visible. He will always be visible to us because he will always possess a body. Satan can't do any of that. So he has to make it a focuser. And that was the purpose of idols. But it's not enough just to have a religion. You must have a government. Because sin is self-destructive, as we talked about in the past in many of our lessons. You know, when Satan tempted Christ, he offered to make Christ a vizier over all the empires of man. Now, Christ did not dispute Satan's authority, showing Satan is behind all governments, including these empires, represented in Marduk's statue. Christ could have just said, "You don't belong to you. Get out of my face. You bothered me now." Instead, he said something quite different. He did not dispute Satan's authority over these kingdoms. That includes all governments. That includes modern governments. That includes America. See, Isaiah's lament for the king of Babylon speaks of an expansive kingdom not realized by the old, middle, or neo Babylonia, of which Nebuchadnezzar is the representative king here. But he does apply to Satan. And this gives us significant insight into Satan's limitations. So if you turn to Isaiah 14, and you begin in verse 3 and run through verse 20, and obviously we're not going to read all of this, but you should, because it's a lament or a taunt against the king of Babylon, but it's not referring to the king of Babylon. King of Babylon is kind of like a metaphor for Satan, same way in Ezekiel 28. And the king of Tyre is a metaphor for Satan. Now, we see this often in prophetic language, that you can have a near meaning and a far meaning. The near meaning is the king of Babylon. But the far meaning goes beyond him to Satan himself, the power behind him. And it talks about how Satan rules the kingdoms in wrath with continuous blows of persecution. And this kingdom of Satan's mimics Rome, which crushed all it encountered until destroyed by internal decay. And that's exactly what's happening with Satan's kingdom. He's trying to set it up, and yet it is inherently weak. It will inherently fall because of fail in its mission because internal decay, this lack of unity. So if we go down to verse 6 here, that struck the peoples in wrath with unceasing blows, that ruled the nations in anger with unrelenting persecution. But when this is gone, the whole world is at rest. See, Satan made the earth tremble and shook the kingdoms and made the world a desert with his wanton destruction to obtain his unwavering goal, to be his God. Yet Satan's power lay in his words, his lies, rather than inherent in himself. When he is seen at judgment, he will be weak. In verse 10, all of them will answer and say to you, "You have become as weak as we. You have become like us. Your pomp is brought down to Sheol. The sound of your harps, maggots are laid as a bed beneath you and worms your covers. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. How you are cut down to the ground who laid the nations low." Then in verse 16, those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man that made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities, who did not let his prisoners go home? You are cast away from your grave like a loathed branch, clothed with the slain. You will not be joined with them in burial because you have destroyed your land, slain your people. Satan reflected God's glory. It was not his glory. It was not his power. He became confused. He mistook it for his own. But he is like all sinners and will be equally shielded with those he sought to rule over as God. See, Satan bypasses burial. He's spirit. He goes directly into the lake of fire. And we say Satan, we mean Satan and demons. They all go together. And we read this in Revelation 20, verse 10. He is picked up and thrown in the lake of fire, where his two minions, that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, the Antichrist, the false prophet, have been for 1,000 years, waiting for him. So this kingdom of iron and clay, it claims unity, but it's torn by division. He's planning to gather all people who think very differently from himself into a collective to fulfill his goal as being God. It's inherently self-defeating. He can't do it. These kingdoms, as I said, represent his learning curve. But just as Satan used violence and sinning, his empires rely on violence, wars to enslave others. Yet man also seeks power apart from Satan. All are slaves to sin. We have to remember this, that in the background is this quality of sin that enslaved everyone. Ezekiel 28, verse 15 and 16, you were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till unrighteousness was found in you. In the abundance of your trade, you were filled with violence in your midst, and you sinned. So I cast you as a profane thing from the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O guardian cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was proud because you corrupted your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. Cast you to the ground. I exposed you before kings to feast their eyes on you. It's just not pretty. Satan used certain people as surrogates, government heads, such as Nebuchadnezzar, Cyrus, Alexander, Caesar, etc. However, these have also been used of God preparing the world for Christ's coming, both his first and his second. Satan consistently fails because he does not understand man, who, in his sinful state, is also uncontrollable. And force exacerbates man's rebellious sinful nature. Remember, in the beginning, Genesis 3:5, Satan told Boy, you too will be as God, knowing good and evil. Now, if he had thought that through, he probably said, well, what am I releasing here? We're all going to want to be God. I can control him. I got this. Well, no, he didn't. He didn't have it at all. He unleashed that which he could not control. It's like trying to ride the whirlwind. But he's going to try it. And he's going to continue to do it. He's going to continue to fail. He cannot do it. He does not understand us. Yet, neither do we understand him. And both are locked in ignorance of sin. And both are driven to gain power over others, even to slaughtering untold millions throughout history. until God has, not has to, but God intervenes because the point has been made. That all sinners are desperately sinful and will not change. See, this is evidenced by empires destroying other empires rather than joining together in a permanent bond. Now, America's Civil War, Lincoln's War, it's just another example of this. Two different philosophies, and rather than sit down and negotiating, they had to go to war. Well, that tears everything down. Wars do not build up. Wars do not integrate. Wars destroy. You may overcome a people, but they will keep agitating unless they become like you. They will eventually rebel. We saw this in our lesson in Babylonia. Every time you had a new king, all the vassal states would rebel, trying to find better deals, trying to reestablish themselves. Because this is what man does. This is what sinners do. They rebel. Now, what is religion? See, God's nature is a source of right and wrong. Morality. We'll just use that word to represent that. Since he is creator. Yet sin is rebellion against God, rejecting God's morality, i.e. ungodliness. Now, this morality is inside each one of us. Romans 1, 18 through 32. We know it. That's why it's the same wrongs in all cultures throughout history. And religion is just the way to codify this. See, man's gods were metaphors which legalized their morality, but were discarded as man's measure of morality became self. Like Satan. Satan has, he is the measure of all things to himself. But sinners are unstable in all their ways because they're unwise. They have their own wisdom, but it's like stepping on sand. As Christ said, it's like building a house on sand in Matthew 7. See, religion is collected of like-minded people reinforcing their morality and its source via rites and rituals. Members joining the group must accept the source. This is what religion is. You're constantly reinforcing your morality, reinforcing the source of your morality. We saw this in the Protestant faith. Once they escaped the clutches of Rome and became state religions themselves, they turned from being persecuted to persecuting those who were different. Because they were now arms of the state. Well, Catholicism was trying to become an arm of the state also. In fact, it was trying to become the state. It just never quite attained that. But it too persecuted all who were different. Because that's what religions do. It reinforces among the group trying to keep God out, trying to keep God's truth out, and gathering around their own source and trying to guard the truth. It's not really the truth, but it's their truth. But government is a collection of like-minded people forcing their morality on the group via laws, preventing change to another morality. They're working together, one supporting the other. And wars are struggles of moralities. When it comes right down to it, that is exactly what wars are. Wars of morality. And America is taking its morality of democracy, which is ill-defined anyway, out into the vast reaches of the world at gunpoint. No different than any other empire. See, government cannot exist without religion. It has to have a morality. because government legislates morality. Therefore, it must have a basis, a source that legitimizes its morality, of which is right and wrong. And government can only do this via force. And it does it to preserve and then expand the group. Differences are despised. So, the two come together. That's what a theocracy is. Well, you say, well, America does not have a state religion. But it does. It's secularism. Human secularism. That's pretty much what most Western governments are. Islam is on Allah. Communism is another form of secular humanism. Atheism in itself is a religion. It's a basis of morality of right and wrong to explain it by rejecting God. But still an explanation of morality. See, Satan's future kingdom of iron and clay evidences reliance on religion to promote government to enslave people with their consent, if possible. Now, you're going to obtain their consent because you're going to give them few options otherwise. See, Satan in Revelation 12, 17, going down to 13:10, we see Satan standing on the shore of the sea, calling forth his human representative, the Antichrist, who willingly submits to Satan's indwelling. Now, that's important. He's been groomed for this. He's willing. Now, does that make him stable? Probably not. But it doesn't make him totally out of control like the early attempts that we saw in the Gospels. See, and the false prophet arises from the land, receiving power from Satan also, promoting Antichrist government by providing a moral basis supported by signs. We all want to see miracles. One of the largest categories of movies today is fantasy, miracles, gods, bells, everything. Even superheroes are nothing but metaphors for gods. And the false prophet unites all false religions into his overarching union based upon their commonality of man is God. Man is the measure of all. And it focuses them on the Antichrist, who is Satan's intercessor. Rather than, and they're going to do it through an image. This idol will be built representing the Antichrist, representing the one that the Antichrist is pointing to, which would be Satan. Remember, his spirit can't be seen. And you will either consent by paying obeisance to this idol and live and be able to survive in this centralized, rationed economy, or you would be killed. Now, that sounds exactly like the emperor worship of the old Rome, the iron. But Christ's kingdom is formed by each person receiving a new nature. A new covenant of grace has always been God's gospel plan. We saw in Jeremiah 31:31, the new covenant. This is always the focus. In 2 Corinthians 5:17, when we're saved, we receive a new nature. All things, old things, have passed away. See, God, through the Son, unified with man that was not present at creation. Yes, God walked with Adam, but he didn't live with Adam, and he certainly didn't indwell him. Adam was flesh. Adam had his own nature. He was made the image of God, but he did not have God's nature. Because there are certain aspects that cannot just be given. They have to be experienced. And if we're going to be as God, we must understand the difference between good and evil and choose the good. Now, in the beginning, man just had to live in good and was told not to get into this. Of course, the flesh says, I want it, and whatever it is, I'm going to do it. We always try to expand until we hit that area that we do not do well in, the Peter principle. But demonic's attempt to indwell people against their will, as we saw, had been disastrous and displays the powerlessness of Satan and demons unless one allows the indwelling. You see, even Satan and his demons remain separate from man. The two cannot be one. Even people become one through marriage, showing a vast gulf between Satan and people. Angels know nothing of this unity, but every single person does. Now you lost, that unity is transitory. That unity is superficial. It didn't used to be quite that way, but in modern times it's becoming much more so. But angels don't know nothing of that. And don't want any part of that. Now I'm not saying they don't want to engage in experiencing the fleshly appetites, but it drives them literally insane. They have to be chained up, unless they destroy everything. No matter how much force is brought to bear, the two kinds cannot unify. And attempts to do this result in rebellion, one versus the other, all trying to be gods, until all eventually acknowledge Christ is God. So let's once again look at the various aspects of Marduk's statue. We spent so much time on this because God has spent so much time on this. And though Daniel explains it very simply in chapter 7, he's going to unpack it even more. And Daniel will see it from God's perspective. See, right now we're really just seeing this from Nebuchadnezzar's perspective and in historical perspective. But in Daniel chapter 7, we'll see it from a spiritual perspective. But we don't want to conflate the two just yet. We have other ground to cover before we get there. So the gold never tarnishes, and Nebuchadnezzar was to shine like the sun because he's the only one who saved. Silver tarnishes black. Cyrus, though anointed of God, and used to send Jews back to Jerusalem, yet no record of his or his posterity's salvation, and Persia became the birthplace of Zoroastrianism, which is a type of monotheism that worships fire and light, mainly fire. And bronze, the green patina that dulls the sheen, Alexander quickly spread the Greek culture, but succumbed to Oriental mysticism, declaring himself a god. Then he died, showing he wasn't a god, because he died. Iron rusts red, unhalted. Rust destroys the metal. Caesar turned Rome from an oligarchy, ruled the few, into a monarchy, ruled by one, who became worshipped as God, and then died. Iron and clay, these appear strong, but cannot become a unity, and succumb to decay of sin and destruction, as we're going to see in our next lesson. Empires require morality, and kings cannot rule without people. See, anybody can declare themselves king. I am king of this room. I am king of my house. But really, you possess no authority except by force over others or by consent of the others. But since all is in sin, even the saved sin, we still have the body of flesh. That consent usually is transitory. It comes and goes. It's like the waves of the sea. So the head received the law from a higher source. King was mediator and interpreter of the law for the people. The chest empire made the laws, but the king was as subject to the laws as the people and could not change them without risk of removal or disintegration of the empire. The loins, laws governed by man's philosophies, is a transition from higher source of law to man as the source of law. And this debate continues today. What are rights? What are my rights? Natural rights. These are all philosophies of man. Why? The legs, laws arbitrarily contrived, according to the dictates of the ruler who is God. All authority comes from the ruler, yet he is subject to the whims of the mob. The Roman emperor was emperor, but he did not have absolute control. He could be assassinated, showing he wasn't God. But he was constantly trying to placate the mob through socialism. That was actually codified and revived in the French Revolution, and then incorrectly interpreted by Marx. But with its failure in the Soviet Revolution, it morphed into a different type of emphasis, a different type of socialism, through the Gramsci writings and the School of Frankfurt and the Fabian Society, the Club of Rome, the Open Society Foundations. These are all working to initiate a different kind of globalization, a different type of socialism to enslave the entire world. But once again, you cannot enslave the entire world. It doesn't work very well. And the laws are based on Greco-Roman ideas, but tailored to enslave the people with their consent to Antichrist, who is legitimized by the false prophet of a new faith. Satan's 10-state coalition cannot be identified until its time, and attempts to do so have drawn people away from sound exegesis. His kingdom comes because God allows sinners to realize their dream of a world without him. This is why Christ said the world gets worse and worse and not better. Satan's government is a top-down tyranny, but man's government is a bottom-up democratic tyranny. Yet both reject God and rely on force for compliance. However, they remain incompatible. Even though Antichrist is successful in his confederation, he cannot unite everyone into one government. Thus, they have to meet in the Valley of Megiddo, near Mount Carmel, or, as it's known in the Hebrew, Har Megiddo, or in the Greek, Armageddon. That's where that word comes from. But they do so as a battle of armies, because that's what the lost do. They force immorality on each other by force, which is sin, violence, degradation, and death, all based on lies. Christians must focus only on the gospel, evangelizing, and not government. How can you redeem that which is lost? How can you redeem that which is governed by the lost? We work within the government, but we are to evangelize for Christ. And all kingdoms are removed when Christ returns to establish his kingdom, as we're going to see in our next lesson. I hope that you have enjoyed this part of our study in Daniel. It's deceptively simple. Surprisingly complex. And we must not be lulled into a false sense of complete knowledge just because we can put a name to a kingdom to a level. The purpose here is to show us what is going on in our time. But we cannot change those events. Satan will have his way. And God will allow him to have his way, so he can show himself to be exceedingly gracious to those whom he saves. And to those who wish to live without him, they will have their wish in the lake of fire for all eternity. Thank you.